What's up, everybody? Cameron here, along with my co-host.
Nicole on the floor.
Nicole is in a bundle on the floor right now recording. She's super cozy. We're getting back to you with another disaster. I don't know why the historical disasters
you just love disasters
so big for me, but this one did have some conspiracy at the time and some mystery shrouding it. We're going to be talking about the Hindenburg disaster.
The blimp.
I'm guessing based off that, you know, at least a little of the Hindenburg or what it was.
It's a blimp.
Okay. Yeah. It's a, you maybe would remember the famous, the humanity and the famous footage of the Hindenburg. So the Hindenburg disaster was an airship accident that occurred on May 6, 1937 in Manchester Township, New Jersey. It was a disaster that was essentially the end of commercial airships and something you're probably familiar with whether you know it or not. You may have seen the infamous footage of the explosion or remember the famous, "Oh, the humanity," quote. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is an event that has entered the zeitgeist and is still referenced all these years later. Despite the obvious fallbacks of using a large amount of hydrogen to keep these crafts afloat, we will come to see in this episode that the events and causes of the Hindenburg crash were more complex and shrouded in more mystery than one might think.
Ooh, can't wait.
Before we get into the event itself, so what is an airship? An airship, or dirigible balloon, is a type of aerostat or lighter-than-air aircraft which can navigate through the air under its own power. Mm-hmm. Aerostats gain their lift from gases that are less dense than the air surrounding it. So it's basically a big balloon with a propeller on it. That is an aerostat.
Yeah.
So throughout history, they've seen three main usages, passenger airships, military airships, whether bombing or spying, mm-hmm. and then obviously what we have today is just commercial advertising. But, I mean, even then, they've always kind of been used for that, we'll see. Mm-hmm. So, the start of airships. So, to get to aerostats, we first have to take a look at the predecessor, the hot air balloon.
Great.
We don't really, but I thought this was kind of fun. So, hot air balloons were first flown by the brothers Joseph and Étienne Montgolfier. Also, warning, it's a bunch of French coming up, and I'm terrible at it. Sorry, hot air balloons come from France. Their first demonstrated flight of a hot air balloon took place on June 4th, 1783 in Annonay, France. On September 19th, 1783 in Versailles, the hot air balloon was carrying a sheep, a rooster, and a duck, and it flew for 8 minutes in front of Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette. So the first manned flight occurred October 15th, 1783. Palliatre de Rosière and Marquise de Arlandes were the first human passengers on the balloon. The balloon was in free flight, meaning it wasn't tethered on this one.
I don't think I would ever volunteer to be like one of the first people to go
air
balloon.
First ones?
Yeah.
So it wasn't long before we had our first disasters.
In
1785, the pioneer balloonist Jean-Francis Pellet de Rosière, the one we talked about before, the first manned flight, and pilot Pierre Romain died when their balloon caught fire, possibly from a stray spark, and crashed during an attempt to cross the English Channel.
Not because it was made out of fabric?
Well, they were the first to die in a balloon crash. So Frenchman Jacques Charles invented the first hydrogen balloon in 1783. So now we're not getting on the hot air, we're moving on to actual gases.
Okay.
Less than 2 weeks after the groundbreaking Montgolfier flight, so it was right after that that someone else was like, I could do this better. The French physicists Jacques Charles and Nicolas Robert made the first untethered ascension with a gas hydrogen balloon on December 1st, 1783. So this is all going on at the same time. It's a balloon race.
Great.
Jacques Charles combined his expertise in making hydrogen with Nicolas Robert's new method of coating silk with rubber. So we had a gas and a fabric band coming together to make our first dirigible.
Great.
The Charlier hydrogen balloon exceeded the earlier Montgolfier hot air balloon in time in the air and distance traveled. With its wicker gondola, netting, and valve and ballast system, it became the definitive form of the hydrogen balloon for the next 200 years. The audience in the Tuileries Gardens was reported as 400,000, half the population of Paris, to see this thing take off. Jesus. So you may be asking yourself, where are the Germans in all of this? What of the German Zeppelin? And if you're not aware, Germans were renowned for their innovation in aerostat aviation. They were a leading pioneer in the wave travel and were using the craft as a sort of propaganda for the Nazi party.
Hmm.
Zeppelin was the name given to the duraluminum internal framed dirigibles invented by the Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin.
The whole first thing that you just said sounded made up.
Saying essentially the framed dirigible that has just a frame and then a coating on it is what we're talking about here.
Uh-huh.
Its skeleton and outer cover were made of aluminum, mm-hmm. powered by a 12-horsepower gas engine connected to three propellers. It lifted off successfully in a tethered test near Berlin, Germany. However, the airship crashed on its maiden voyage. So right. once again, these are really dangerous.
But yet we carry on.
Zeppelin flew the world's first untethered rigid airship, the LZ-1, on July 2nd, 1900, near Lake Constance in Germany, and it carried five live passengers.
These passengers.
Brave souls.
Yeah.
In 1908, Ferdinand Zeppelin established the Friedrichstein, the Zeppelin Foundation.
Wow.
Again, sorry for pronunciation. For the development of aerial navigation and the manufacture of airships. So the development of the subsequent manufacture of the 20 vessels gave Germany an initial military advantage at the start of World War I. This is kind of why Germany is known for its blimps and the Zeppelin. It was Germany's successful use of the Zeppelin for military reconnaissance missions that spurred the British Royal Navy to create its own airships. Rather than duplicating the design of the German rigid airship, the British manufactured several small non-rigid balloons. And these airships were successfully used to detect German submarines and were classified as British Class B airships. It's quite possible this is where the term blimp originates, Class B plus limp or non-rigid. So Class B, limp, blimp.
Limp.
German Zeppelins had the capability of traveling 85 miles per hour and carrying up to 2 tons of bombs. With military deadlock on the Western Front, they decided to use them against towns and cities in Britain. Although they didn't have great maneuverability, the stealthiness with which they could descend on a city in the dead of night stoked fear in the British people. They were virtually silent and invisible in the night sky, and had the ability to hover for long periods of time and drop multiple payloads.
Whoa.
The Zeppelins flew too high for the airplanes of the time to reach and shoot them down. Their only real vulnerability was the hydrogen gas bags used to lift. Ordinary bullets might pierce the bags, but something different was needed if the Zeppelin was made to explode. With the invention of the Buckingham incendiary bullet, which not only pierced the bags but also ignited the hydrogen, the Zeppelin threat was effectively neutralized. German Zeppelins made flights of almost 100-hour durations. Such performances led many to believe that large airships would play a prominent part in aviation development. During the 1920s and 30s, Britain, Germany, and the United States focused on developing large, rigid, passenger-carrying airships. Unlike Britain and Germany, the United States primarily used helium to give their airships lift. Found in small quantities in natural gas deposits in the United States, helium is quite expensive to make, however, and is not flammable, obviously, like hydrogen. Yeah. So, because of the cost involved in its manufacture, the United States banned the exportation of helium to other countries, forcing Germany and Britain to rely on more volatile hydrogen gas. So wow. that is the main thing. It was wartime, and we just had a hold on it. So due to their usage in war, there were, of course, crashes, explosions, and casualties.
Yeah.
Apart from wartime usage, though, passenger carriers also met their share of disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the Hindenburg wasn't the first or deadliest crash in airship history, it is still the most famous. Partly because of the enormous news coverage documenting the landing, but also the mystery revolving around why did it crash?
Why?
Before we get to the Hindenburg itself, let's briefly take a look at these other airships and their death tolls.
Oh, great.
So these are just aerial stats, just airships.
Oh, okay.
September 9th, 1913, the Zeppelin LZ-14 crashes. 14 drowned, 6 survivors. That's our first one. That's the first fatal Zeppelin accident.
But still, the amount of people that survived, not too bad.
Not too bad. October 17th, 1913, Zeppelin 18 explodes in midair and crashes during a test flight. All 28 are killed.
Oof.
June 20th, 1914, a Hungary military airship collides with an army plane. All 7 people die and 2 people in the biplane. September.
So we went from 30% survival rate to 0.
Yeah. There's some big bad ones. There's a bigger death toll in the Hindenburg. September 3rd, 1915, Zeppelin LZ-40 is destroyed by fire after getting struck by lightning, killing 19 crew members.
Jesus.
November 10th, 1915, Imperial Germany Navy ship kills all 20 on takeoff. It explodes right after takeoff.
Right after takeoff?
Right after takeoff, February 1916, another Imperial Germany Navy L-19 comes down in the North Sea off the coast of the Netherlands after a mid-air raid on the United Kingdom. All 16 survived the crash, but then all end up dying because British rescuers refused to take the Germans. So they all died at sea. This is a bad one. January 5th, 1918, a hangar exploded, the LZ-87. So this is looking like Germany. It kills 15, injures 134. Because it's, it was the hangar.
Yeah.
April 7, 1918, Imperial Germany Navy L-59 explodes over Malta for reasons unknown, killing all 21. July 15, 1919.
Great.
Royal Navy North Sea class airship NS-11 burns over the North Sea of Norfolk, England, killing 12.
So they average about 20 people.
July 21st, 1919, American airship Wingfoot Air Express catches fire over downtown Chicago. Two passengers, one crew member, and 10 people on the ground died, while two parachuted to safety.
Oh.
So two survived that one. August 23rd, 1921, British R-38 built for the U.S. Navy and already carrying ZR-2 markings breaks in half and catches fire after suffering structural failure during high-speed trials. 44 die and 5 survive.
Hmm.
February 21st, 1922. U.S. Army airship hits power lines in Virginia and burns out, killing 34 of the 45 on board. Oh, also, I cut out any that were under 10 deaths. There were so many that just killed a couple.
Oh, okay.
Like, I started at the beginning with some of those light ones, but then after the beginning of everyone dying.
It still seems like a lot, though, from 1913 to where are we right
again,
now?
Again, a lot of this is wartime, though, also. Yeah, a lot of these are wartime. December 1923, French Navy LZ-114 explodes in midair over the Mediterranean Sea near Sicily, following an apparent lightning strike.
You know, it's really bad to just go over bodies of water.
It seems so. All 50 aboard die. October 5th, 1930. We're getting a little higher now in the dates. No, we're not. No, yeah, we just jumped like 7 years. British experimental design R-101 nosedives into the ground during a rainstorm in France and burns out. 48 are killed. 6 survive. The crash, the deadliest involving a civilian airship, ended the British airships at the time. Oh, yeah, this one was a bad one. The USS Akron crashes.
Any of them are good ones.
This one's a bad one. The okay. USS Akron crashes at sea off the coast of New Jersey in severe storm with 73 dead, many drowned, and 3 survivors. It remains the deadliest airship accident in history. So as we can see...
Not great.
Even though some of this is war-related... This was a dangerous way to travel.
Yeah.
Let's get into the Hindenburg flight. We'll talk about, we'll go.
Boy, oh boy.
We'll go through the Hindenburg's last day, then we'll go through the conspiracy theories
involving
it. Nothing
will brighten up my spirits other than hearing about more death.
The Hindenburg began its last flight on May 3rd, 1937, carrying 36 passengers and 61 crew officers. It was the airship's 63rd flight and the 11th trip to America. The airship left Frankfurt Airport at 7:16 p.m. and flew over the Atlantic shortly after 2 a.m. the next day. The Hindenburg followed a northern track across the ocean, passing the southern tip of Greenland and crossing the North American coast at Newfoundland. Headwinds delayed the airship's passage across the Atlantic, and the Lakehurst arrival, which had been scheduled for 6 a.m. on May 6th, was postponed until 6 p.m., 12 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
The ship flew south from New York and arrived at the Naval Air Station at Lakehurst, New Jersey, around 4:15 p.m. But the poor weather conditions at the field concerned the Hindenburg's commander, Captain Max Preuss, and also Lakehurst's commanding officer, Charles Rosenthal, who sent a message to the ship recommending a delay in landing until conditions improved. Captain Preuss departed the Lakehurst area and took the ship over to the beaches and coast of New Jersey to wait out the storm.
Mm-hmm.
By 6 p.m., conditions had improved. At 6:12, Rosenthal sends Preuss a message relaying temperature, pressure, visibility, and winds, which Rosenthal considered suitable for landing. At 6:22, Rosenthal radioed Preuss recommending landing now. And at 7:08, Rosenthal sent a message to the ship strongly recommending the earliest possible landing. Hindenburg approached the field at Lakehurst from the southwest shortly after 7 p.m. at an altitude of approximately 600 feet. Since the wind was from the east, after passing over the field to observe conditions on the ground, Captain Preuss initiated a wide left turn to fly a descending oval pattern around the north and west of the field to line up for landing into the wind into the east. So he was going to have to do, he's changing course now to do a big wide turn.
Yeah.
While Captain Preuss, who was directing the ship's heading and engine power settings, brought Hindenburg around the field, the first officer, Albert Sammet, who was responsible for the ship's trib at altitude, assisted by watch officer Walter Ziegler at the gas board and second officer Heinrich Bauer at the ballast board, valved 15 seconds of hydrogen along the length of the ships to reduce the Hindenburg's buoyancy in preparation for landing.
Okay.
As Proust continued the slow left turn of the oval landing pattern, reducing and then reversing the power from the engines, Samet noticed that the ship was heavy in the tail and valved hydrogen from cells 11 and 16 in the bow, for a total of 30 seconds to reduce the buoyancy of the bow and to keep the ship level and trim. When this failed to level the ship, Samet ordered 3 drops of water ballast, totaling 2,420 pounds, from ring 77 in the tail, and then valved an additional 5 seconds of hydrogen from the forward gas cells. When even these measures could not trim the ship, 6 crewmen were ordered to go forward and add their weight to the bow.
What?
So we've been so far leaking hydrogen out of the cells, right, to bring it down. And we're dropping water ballast, and it took also sending 6 guys back. For some reason, they can't just get it level and trim right now.
Right.
While Samet was working to keep the ship trim, the wind shifted directions from the east to the southwest. Captain Proust now needed to land into the wind on a southwesterly heading, rather than the easterly heading that he had originally intended when he had planned the oval landing pattern. Mm-hmm. Hindenburg was now close to the landing area, however, and did not have a lot of room to maneuver before reaching the mooring mast. Anxious to land quickly before weather conditions could deteriorate, Captain Proust decided to execute a tight S-turn to change the direction of the ship's landing. Proust ordered a turn to port to swing out and then a sharp turn to the starboard line for the landing into the wind. Some experts would later theorize that this sharp turn overstressed the ship. After the S-turn to change the direction of landing, Proust continued his approach to the mooring mast, adjusting power from the 2 forward and rear engines. And at 7:21, with the ship about 180 feet above the ground, the forward landing ropes were dropped. Mm-hmm. A few minutes after the landing ropes were dropped, R.H. Ward, in charge of the port bow landing party, noticed what he described as a wave-like fluttering out of the cover of the port side between frames 62 and 77, which contained gas cell number 5. He testified at the Commerce Department inquiry that it appeared to him as if gas were pushing against the cover, having escaped from the cell.
Hmm.
Ground crew member R.W. Antrim, who was at the top of the mooring mast, also testified that he saw that the covering behind the rear port engine fluttering. At 7:25 p.m., the first visible external flames appeared. Reports vary, but most witnesses saw the first flames either at the top of the hull just forward of the vertical fin near the ventilation shafts between cells 4 and 5, or between the rear port engines and the port fin in the area of the gas cells of 4 and 5, where Ward and Antrim had seen the fluttering. Lakehurst Commander Rosenthal described a mushroom-shaped flower of flame burst into bloom in front of him in the upper fin. Navy Lieutenant Benjamin May, the assistant mooring officer who was at the top of the mooring mast, testified that an area just behind the rear port engine, where Ward and Atrium reported the fluttering, seemed to collapse, after which he saw streaks of flame followed by a muffled explosion, and then the entire tail was engulfed by flame. Several witnesses inside the ship also saw the beginning of the fire. Helmsman Helmut Law, who was stationed in the auxiliary control stand in the lower fin, heard a muffled detonation and looked up and saw from the starboard side, down inside the gas cell, a bright reflection on the front bulkhead of cell number 4. The fire quickly spread and soon engulfed the tail of the ship, but the ship remained level for a few more seconds before the tail began to sink and the nose pointed upward toward the sky, with a blowtorch of flame erupting from the bow where 12 crew members were stationed, including the 6 men who were sent there to keep it trim. So they are instantly dead.
Yeah.
In the port and starboard promenades on the passenger decks, where many of the passengers and some of the crew had gathered to watch the landing, the rapidly increasing angle of the ship caused passengers and crew to tumble against the walls. Passenger Margaret Mather recalled being hurled 15 to 20 feet against the rear wall of the dining room and then being pinned by a bench and several other people. So the survival and death. The fire spread so quickly, consuming the ship in less than a minute, that survival was largely a matter of where one happened to be located when the fire broke out. Passengers and crew members began jumping out of the promenade windows to escape the burning ship, and most of the passengers and all the crew...
They were still like 100 and something feet up the away off the ground, right?
Well, and especially when it caught fire, the nose of the ship where...
And they said it went like up.
Yeah, where the gondola and the passengers are, it went almost 90 degrees vertical before it started crashing back into the ground. So what we'll see here in a second in more descriptions, the people were essentially clinging to the windows, waiting for it to get a little lower than jumping, yeah, really far.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So passenger and crew members began jumping out of the promenade windows to escape the burning ship. And most of the passengers and all the crew who were in public rooms on an A deck at the time of the fire, close to the promenade windows, did survive. Those who were deeper inside the ship in the passenger cabins at the center of the decks or the crew spaces along the keel did generally die in the fire. Hmm. One passenger, John Paynes, the New York manager for the Hamburg America line, which handled passenger reservations for the Deutsche Zeppelin, was in the dining room when the fire broke out. Encouraged to jump by the ship's photographer, Carl Otto Clemens, who escaped through one of the windows and survived. Paynes instead left the dining room to find his wife, Emma, who had returned to their cabin for her coat. Both died in the fire. Mr. and Mrs. Hammond Dwyer and their three children, Irene, Walter, and Werner, Irene was 16, Walter 10, and Werner 8, were also in the dining room watching the landing, but Mr. Dwyer left before the fire broke out. Miss Doe and her two young sons jumped to safety, but Irene left the dining room to search for her father, and both died as a result of the crash. There's actually interviews with a lot of these people, because there were, as of like 20 years ago, people were still alive from this.
Right.
But this one was really sad. It was like it was a family's trip going together, and the mom threw the son out of the window because he was too scared to jump, and his sister was essentially terrified and just ran, so they both died.
Wow.
Given the speed with which the Hindenburg burned, survival for the crew was also largely a matter of luck. Those who were deep inside the ship, such as the electricians in the power room along the keel, or Max Schultz in the smoking room bar on B deck, or those on the starboard side, since the flaming ship rolled slightly to the starboard side as it hit the ground,
yeah,
were generally trapped in the wreck. And the men stationed in the bow, who were exposed to the column of flame that rose up the ship as the bow pointed skyward, had the least chance. The nine men who were closest to the front of the ship at the time were all dead by fire. As the ship settled to the ground less than 30 seconds after the flames had been observed, those who had jumped from the burning craft scrambled to safety, as did members of the ground crew who had been positioned in the field below the ship at the time to get the ropes. Natural instinct caused those on the ground to run from the burning wreck as fast as they could, but Chief Petty Officer Frederick J. Bull Tobin, a longtime airship veteran and an enlisted airship pilot who was in charge of the Navy landing party, cried out, "Sailor, Navy men, stand fast!" Bull Tobin had survived the crash of the USS Shenandoah, and he was not about to abandon those in peril on this airship, even if it meant his own life. Films of the disaster clearly show sailors turning and running back from these words of encouragement. So the final toll. Hindenburg left Frankfurt with 97 souls aboard. 62 survived the crash at Lakehurst, although many suffered serious injuries. 13 of the 36 passengers and 22 of the 61 crew died as a result of the crash, along with one member of the ground crew of the landing party, Alan Hageman. So the conspiracies. But first,
sorry.
Let's take a look at the video.
There's a video.
Yeah. Okay, so we just took a little break for Nicole to watch the video. We watched a couple different newscasts. We did the famous Herbert Morris from Chicago, the Humanity one.
Yeah.
So now, after hearing all this information, seeing the disaster.
Holy shit.
It happened very quickly.
Super quick.
Yeah, I mean, and it's just a crazy.
It was just like one corner was aflame, and then the other corner just was aflame, and then it just went.
As soon as the hydrogen and then cells it went, caught, it's just gone. So we've taken a look at the history of the air travel, the disaster, so you might be wondering, what's the great mystery here?
Mm-hmm.
The cause of the explosion was never conclusively determined, and there were also...
Hydrogen.
And there were also threats against the Nazi Party Zeppelin Company, which brought foul play into question.
Okay.
We know that hydrogen was released from the balloons and came into contact with the spark that igniting it.
Yep.
But what or who made the conditions possible for this disaster? We'll take a look into some of the theories and conspiracies as to what could have made that possible.
Okay.
Sabotage was suspected from the start. So the Zeppelin Company had received a threat at the German embassy in New York that a bomb was going to be placed on the airship for this travel.
Okay.
But it was never taken seriously. The Nazi Party was on the rise, and the airship, which worked as a large propaganda advertisement for the regime, had obviously gained attention. You might have seen from the photo, but all the Zeppelin aerostats had swastikas on the fins.
Mm-hmm.
So they were essentially big propaganda, just like, look at our might, look at our airships. There had been other threats to the airships in the past because of their Nazi ties, but after the disaster, they needed to re-examine all possibilities of conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
The creator of the Hindenburg, Dr. Hugh Eckner, learned of the crash from a 1 a.m. phone call from a New York reporter asking for his reaction. He immediately set off to assist in the investigation, but it would take him 6 days to arrive.
Okay.
The wreckage was put under military guard, and a board of inquiry was established by the U.S. Commerce Department to look into the cause of the explosion and crash. The next morning, Ground Crew Commander Charles Rosenthal began interviewing survivors, starting with the worst and working his way up to make sure that no one would pass before, you know, possibly having key information.
Right.
During his interview with crewmen, he was told that there was an explosion before the entire vessel exploded. And he was also told that there was a large clang or crack noise which was heard as the Hindenburg made its sharp turn to redirect in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
With this news, the investigation focused on a foul play motive. The idea being that some small incendiary device was placed aboard and caused the explosion. It also became evident through interviews that the landing had been done hastily, putting a lot of stress on the structure maneuvering to battle the changing weather.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI also immediately became involved, which struck Dr. Eckner as odd when he arrived to the States. It seemed that they were already full swing in the foul play conspiracy theory. Dr. Eckner stayed at the Rosenthal family during his stay in the U.S., and on the night of his arrival, Commander Rosenthal was called to the crash site by the FBI because footprints had been found in the mud on the secure crash site. But, I mean, it was just, they thought it might be saboteurs or, like, someone looking at it, but it was looky-loos. It was just, you know.
Yeah.
It was a huge crash. There were a lot of people coming to see it. Or it was likely reporters or something else.
Yeah.
In their investigation of the people aboard who might have a motive or opportunity to plant a bomber device, one person of interest did occupy a lot of inquiry.
Who?
Joseph Spa. Joseph Spa was a comedian, acrobatist, and contortionist.
Suspicious.
Right. He was born on March 14th, 1905 in Strasbourg, France.
Mm-hmm.
He immigrated to the United States as a young man and got into vaudeville as an acrobat and contortionist.
Okay.
He eventually took the stage name Ben Dova. Right. And developed a comedy act which centered around his acrobatic skills.
I get it.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
He's a funny guy.
Ben Dova.
He was scheduled to play Radio Music Hall after a run through Europe. And after a missed ship back to the States, he raised money for a ticket aboard the Hindenburg. Staff noted during their interviews that Spa arrived late to the airship's boarding, nearly missing that trip as well. He was traveling with a dog that he was bringing with him as a present for his children, and because of this, he would have access to the ship's staff areas in order to care for it.
Uh-huh.
Security noted that Spa was making a lot of jokes at check-in, which they did not find amusing. And I can make a note that German customs were not a cheery bunch.
Nope.
The agreement made with Joseph Spa was that he was to have staff escort him through the center of the ship to the cargo hold in order to feed and care for the dog. He would have to travel the center walkway through the center of the ship to do all this. As this was something that needed to be done multiple times a day, staff admitted that he had been left alone and had seen traveling alone on occasion in the secure areas, receiving a scolding on one occasion from a higher officer, but
yeah,
he had probably been alone quite a bit back there.
Interesting.
Because of his profession as an acrobat, as well as his foreign ties, it was thought that he may have been able to maneuver through the rigging and wiring of the airship and able to, like, plant a device somewhere, maybe hidden around one of the cells in the back of the ship. People had reported him acting suspicious aboard, and his use of a video camera had brought the attention of some. And there actually, that his camera did survive. There's actually a lot of
really?
Onboard footage of the
bay. How did his camera survive?
I have no idea. Of, like, the bays. He jumped from the window. He had it on him.
Oh.
But, he was taking a lot of video on the ship, which people thought was suspicious afterwards. But in the end, it seems like it was just revisionist history and scapegoating. He was under investigation and suspicion for quite some time, so I think people kind of put that on later, you know?
Okay.
The FBI investigated him for years, but in the end, he was cleared of all suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
He survived the crash by jumping through a window about 20 feet off the ground as it fell. He broke his ankle, but managed to speak to Chicago reporter Herb Morrison, who we just heard the Humanity.
Yeah.
So we talked to Herb Morrison, who made the famous Oh, the Humanity news, and he managed to give, like, a quick quote about his survival. And then he ended up going to assist in translating German in the pop-up triage station in the hangar, all before getting his broken ankle attended to.
What?
Yeah. So he seems like kind of a stand-up guy. The U.S. and the German governments each concluded their investigations into the crash, releasing their findings in July 1937 and January 1938. Both concluded that atmospheric conditions that evening had led to the disaster, although they differed to the exact mechanism. The Americans suggested an electrical phenomenon called a brush discharge, a slightly luminous electrical discharge between points of high charge density where the charge density is sufficient to cause a spark, or sharp points on a highly charged conductor because of their ionization of air molecules in the vicinity. That's a lot to say, an electrical spark.
Yeah.
So an electrical spark hit already leaking hydrogen, But why is the hydrogen leaking? We still have to figure this out. The Germans favored the spark theory, originally advanced by Hugo Eckner, the creator who was helping the investigation. Despite the natural cause, neither inquiry totally wrote off the possibility of sabotage. So I kind of failed on the other explanation here, but they both essentially thought a natural spark of some sort. I think one is ionized air. I think that's the German one. And then the Americans believe in the brush discharge, which I'm not sure exactly the difference. Sorry. Yeah. Science.
No, that's
okay. So theories. Static electricity hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Hugo Eckner argued that the fire was started by an electrical spark, which was caused by a buildup of static electricity on the airship. Mm-hmm. The spark ignited hydrogen on the outer skin. Theorists of the static spark hypothesis point out that the airship's skin was not constructed in a way that allowed its charge to be distributed evenly throughout the craft. The skin was separated from a duraluminum frame by non-conductive RAMI cores, which had been slightly covered in a metal to improve conductivity, but not effectively, allowing a large difference in potential to form between the skin and the frame. Hmm. So to explain this, essentially, the whole wire framing would need to be grounded, but the skin of the airship where the charge could build up wasn't actually touching the frame. They were each on it. The wiring, there was like a wiring that held the paneling in place, essentially.
Oh, okay.
So that you see how it kind of has that square look?
Yeah.
Each section is its own panel that is like being like suspended, like, and then a coating over it. Mm-hmm. So the idea being that they were all their own separate areas to reduce the charge.
Yeah.
Or more so that the charge could not build up on the skin, then touch the frame at grounding to cause the spark, mm-hmm. was what they meant to do.
Yeah.
But we're going to see here, but they kind of fucked up.
Okay.
In order to make up for the delay of more than 12 hours in the transatlantic flight, the Hindenburg passed through a weather front of high humidity and high electrical charge. Although the mooring lines were not wet when they first hit the ground, the ignition took place 4 minutes after. Eckner theorized that they may have become wet in these 4 minutes. When the ropes which were connected to the frame became wet, they would have grounded the frame, but not the skin.
Okay.
This would have caused a sudden potential difference between the skin and the frame and would have set an electrical discharge, a spark. So what I was just trying to explain, essentially. Seeking the quickest way to the ground, the spark would have jumped from the skin onto the metal frame in between the two, and that could have ignited the leaking hydrogen. And I've seen a bunch of like history and discovery science after this, and it's pretty much been proven because there was a 4 minute delay beforehand, but there of a bunch of repeats in it. It took almost 4 minutes each time for the charge to build up until static started.
Uh-huh.
So the lightning hypothesis. Like many other aircraft, the Hindenburg had been struck by lightning several times in its years. This does not normally ignite a fire in hydrogen airships due to the lack of oxygen. Mm-hmm. However, the airship fires have been observed when lightning strikes the vehicle as it venting hydrogen. However, witnesses did not observe any lightning on touching the ship. So that's not, it didn't, wasn't okay. Lightning, wasn't lightning. Engine
cross
failure.
That one off the
cross
list.
It off. Engine failure. As the airship was approaching the mooring mast, crew member Robert Buchanan noted that one of the engines, thrown into reverse for a hard turn, backfired and a shower of sparks was emitted. After being interviewed by Addison Bain, Buchanan believed that the airship's outer skin was ignited by engine sparks. Another ground crewman, Robert Shaw, saw a blue ring behind the tail fin and had also seen sparks coming out from the engines. Shaw believed that the blue ring he saw was leaking hydrogen, which was ignited by this engine sparks.
Okay.
Eckner rejected the idea that hydrogen could be ignited by engine backfire. Hydrogen could not have been ignited by the exhaust because the temperature is too low to ignite hydrogen. The ignition temperature is 500 Celsius, 932 degrees Fahrenheit, and the sparks only reached 250 Celsius, 42 Fahrenheit. So they couldn't have. The Zeppelin company also carried out extensive tests on hydrogen, had never ignited with the engine backfire or anything from that. Static spark hypothesis. The theory that hydrogen was ignited by a static spark is the most widely accepted theory as determined by the official crash investigation.
That's similar to theory number one then?
Yeah. Offering support for the hypothesis that there was some sort of hydrogen leak prior to the fire is that the airship remained stern heavy before landing. Despite efforts to put the airship back in trim, this could have been caused by a leak of the gas, which started mixing with air, potentially creating a form of oxyhydrogen and filling up the space between the skin and the cells. Mm-hmm. A ground crew member, R.H. Ward, reported seeing the fabric counter fluttering as if gas was escaping from the cell. He said that the fire began there, but that no other disturbance occurred at the time when the fabric fluttered. Another man on the top of the mooring mast, we also said, saw the same thing. And pictures show that the fire started burning along straight lines that coincide with the boundaries of gas cells, suggesting that the fire was not burning along the skin. Crew members stationed in the stern reported actually seeing the cells burn. Two main theories have been postulated as to how the gas could have leaked. Eckner believed a snap bracing wire had torn a gas cell open, while others suggested that a maneuvering or automatic gas valve was stuck open and gas from cell 4 was leaking.
So from him trying to maneuver with the weather?
Mm-hmm. So actually, during the ship's first flight to Rio, a gas cell was nearly emptied when an automatic valve became stuck, and the gas had to be transferred from another cell. So it wasn't uncommon, but it wasn't unheard of for those gas valves to become stuck open, be it like cold weather or just valve problems. So it could have just been stuck open at that time.
Seems reasonable.
Opponents of this hypothesis know that the fire was reported as burning bright red, while pure hydrogen burns blue if visible at all. Although many other materials were consumed by the fire, which gave it the hue, is pretty much the skin. That the only reason we see the fire is because the skin was on fire.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would have been invisible. Incendiary paint. I've heard this one before, that the skin itself was flammable.
Okay.
The incendiary paint theory, IPT, was proposed in 1996 by retired NASA scientist Addison Bain, stating that the doping compound of the airship was the cause of the fire, and that the Hindenburg would have burned if it were filled with helium. The incendiary paint hypothesis asserts that the major component in starting the fire and feeding its spread was the canvas skin because of the compound used on it. Coatings on the fabric contained both iron oxide and aluminum impregnated cellulose acutate butyrate, which remained potentially reactive. That was a lot, sorry. Which remained potentially reactive even after fully setting.
Okay.
Iron oxide and aluminum can be used as components of solid rocket fuel or thermite. Bain received permission from the German government to search the archives and discover evidence. During the Nazi regime, German scientists concluded that the dope on the Hindenburg's fabric skin was the cause of the conflagration. So the Nazi Germany thought it was the skin.
Okay.
Bain interviewed the wife of investigation lead scientist Max Diekmann, and she stated that her husband had told her about the conclusion and instructed her to tell no one, presumably because it would have embarrassed the Nazi government. Additionally, Diekmann concluded that it was poor conductivity, not the flammability of the doping compound, that led to the ignition of the hydrogen. A lot of people have also said just that it wasn't flammable. There's a lot of back and forth on this. One, it was supposed to like deaden the conductivity anyway, and it didn't. Mm-hmm. There were some issues with it. By having each one a separate panel, it actually ended up increasing the risk that there would be a spark, because each panel would become its own conductor, essentially.
Okay.
Puncture hypothesis.
Puncture.
Although Captain Proust believed that the Hindenburg could withstand tight turns without significant damage, proponents of the puncture hypothesis, including Hugo Eckner, questioned the airship's structural integrity after being repeatedly stressed over its flight record. The airship did not receive many inspections, even though there was evidence of at least some damage on the previous flights. It is not known whether the damage was properly repaired or even whether all the failures had been found. During the ship's first return flight from Rio, Hindenburg had once lost an engine and almost drifted over Africa, where it could have crashed. Afterwards, Eckner ordered section chiefs to inspect the airship during flight. So actually, they were always under a bunch of pressure to keep time, just to keep up appearances. And because of that, they had engineers on board doing construction at all times to make fixes.
That's so dumb.
Not the best. However, the complexity of the airship structure would make it virtually impossible to detect all weaknesses in the structure.
Mm-hmm.
In March 1936, the Hindenburg made a 3-day flight to drop leaflets and broadcast speeches via loudspeaker. Before the airship's takeoff on March 26, 1936, Ernest Lehman chose to launch the Hindenburg with the wind blowing from behind the airship instead of into the wind as per standard procedure. During the takeoff, the airship's tail struck the ground and part of the lower fin was broken.
Mm-hmm.
Although that damage was repaired, the force of the impact could have caused more severe internal damage.
Yeah.
Only 6 days before the disaster, it was planned to make the Hindenburg have a hook on her hull to carry an aircraft, similar to the U.S. Navy's use of the USS Akron and the USS Macon ships. However, the trials were unsuccessful as the biplane hit the Hindenburg's trapeze several times. The structure of the airship may have been further affected by this incident of getting hit by a plane.
Hmm.
Newsreels, as well as the map of the landing approach, show that the Hindenburg made several sharp turns, first towards port and then starboard.
Wait, several?
Yeah. Because remember, first they were doing that U shape and they were trying to get the tail fin and everything balanced. And then they had to do the tight S turn. So that would have been like
two to four sharp turns
right there. Hindenburg made several sharp turns, first towards port, then starboard just before the accident. Proponents posit that either of these turns could have weakened the structure near the vertical fins, causing a bracing wire to snap and puncture at least one of the internal gas cells.
Jeez.
Additionally, some of the bracing wires may have been substandard. One bracing wire tested after the crash broke at merely 70% of its rated test load.
Holy crap.
Yeah. A punctured cell would have freed hydrogen into the air and could have been ignited by a static charge. Or it is also possible that the broken bracing wire struck a girder, causing a spark and ignited the hydrogen from within. When the fire started, people on board the airship reported hearing a muffled detonation. A muffled detonation, so like a clang or a bang.
Yeah.
But outside, a crown crew member on the starboard side reported hearing a crack. Some speculate the sound was from a bracing wire snapping. And also, I couldn't find this story, but a few flights before the Hindenburg's faded trip.
Yeah.
There was a Nazi officer who was like new to flying the ship. And he ascended super quick and put a lot of strain on the structure as well. So it seems like there were a lot of things recently that had maybe compromised the integrity of the structure.
Yeah.
Eckner concluded that the puncture hypothesis due to pilot error was the most likely explanation for the disaster. He held Captain Proust and Lehman and Charles Rodenthal responsible.
So just like pilot error in terms of like what you were saying before, like people ascending too fast, people making too many turns, like compromising the structural integrity of...
It seems that there were already things that had damaged it beforehand, but this on top of it with the tight turns might have just been too much and broke the bracing wires. But also, if you look at it, there are a million bracing wires holding this thing together. So like it was saying, if there was even damage, it'd be pretty hard to spot.
Yeah.
Eckner concluded that the puncture hypothesis due to pilot error was most likely explanation for the disaster.
I can believe that.
Same. He held Captain Proust and Charles Rosenthal responsible for what he viewed as a rush landing procedure with the airship badly out of trim under poor weather conditions. Proust had made the sharp turn under Lehman's pressure, while Rosenthal called the airship in for landing, believing the conditions were suitable. Eckner noted that a smaller storm front followed the thunderstorm front, creating conditions suitable for static sparks. So as they were coming in, a new storm front was coming in anyway, and it was slowly starting to drizzle at the time as well, getting the ropes wet as well, conductivity, grounding. During the U.S. inquiry, Eckner testified that he believed that the fire was caused by ignition of hydrogen by a static spark. So he believes that there was a gas, maybe a bracing wire hit a gas cell, and then still the charge buildup on the skin hit the escaping gas.
Okay.
Fuel leak. The 2001 documentary Hindenburg Disaster, Probable Cause, suggests that 16-year-old Bobby Rutan, who claimed that he had smelled gasoline when he was standing below the Hindenburg's aft port engine, had detected a diesel fuel leak. During the investigation, Commander Rosenthal dismissed the boy's report. The day before the disaster, a fuel pump had broken during flight, but the chief engineer testified that the pump had been replaced. The resulting vapor of the diesel leak, in addition to the two engines being overheated, would have been highly flammable and could have self-combusted.
Uh-huh.
However, the documentary makes numerous mistakes into assuming that the fire began in the keel, and pretty much all witnesses reported seeing flames atop the ship. But the only location where the fuel leak could have happened was underneath with the engine. So,
yeah.
Wah, wah.
Wah, wah.
So those are the main theories with this. But if you were to ask me, it seems like a pretty easy one of the static charge buildup and probably a bracing wire or some sort of structural compromise breaking a gas cell.
User error.
Yeah, more than likely. But I thought it was interesting about the Joseph Spa thing. And I mean, initially, everyone thought it was sabotage for quite some time.
Well, I mean, yeah. I was going to say the times.
So that was just kind of a brief look into the Hindenburg and this terrifying, dangerous way of air travel. But
the clips, just watching that thing go down, is just crazy how instantaneous it was.
I mean, yeah, this one doesn't have maybe as much mystery as some, but it was just such a big disaster, and I've been doing disasters that I thought, why not touch this one too?
Yeah.
With that, thanks for listening to our take on the Hindenburg
disaster. Never volunteer to go up in the air.
No, never be a volunteer for anything.
Well, like you could do volunteer for like good.
Never
but if,
volunteer
but
for
if it,
anything.
But if it's a matter of like life, like you're going to probably
die.
Perish doing it. Don't do it.
Just don't.
Please
do
think
it.
About it.
Don't be the first of any sort of travel.
Write a will.
Thanks for listening to our take on the Hindenburg disaster. If you like what you heard, make sure you like and subscribe on your favorite podcast app, rate and review. If you want more content out there, check out the whole Majestic Jam Network, Urban Herman, Cold Classics Podcast. Until then, we'll check you on the next one. Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Nicole on the floor. Talk to you later. Have a good day, everyone. Stay safe.